Welcome to the Tomorrow Brands podcast, where we explore what it takes to build a brand of tomorrow. I'm Ruth Fittock, and I am normally your host, but for this episode, the tables are turned and I was interviewed by Tomorrow Brands commercial lead, Sophia De Crescentis, about my experiences launching Pop Chips in the UK. And just before we start, as this is the last episode of Series 2, I just want to say a massive thank you for listening. I really hope you enjoyed this last one, and we'll be back in the autumn with some very exciting guests.
Today, our own Ruth Fittock will be taking a break from playing host to talk about her time with us at Pop Chips, the most successful snacking launch ever to go down in the snack capital that is the UK. Before we jump into your time at Pop Chips, can you tell us a bit about your background and how you got into FMCG?
Sure. Slightly weird to be on the other side. It's going to be weirder when I have to edit myself, I think, so I'm going to try and be succinct. So I fell into FMCG, really. One of my friends worked in an experiential agency, and she said, oh, actually, there's an opening. And it happened to be Vitamin Water. So the experiential agency, they were Coke's retained agency. So I met the account manager. I remember her showing me the deck and seeing that kind of rainbow lineup of the Vitamin Water drinks and just thinking, that's cool. Had no idea how cool it was, really, because had a kind of Coke-sized budget with a challenger brand sort of startup launch mentality, which is a dream combo, which has never been repeated in my career and probably never will be again. So yeah, I started out agency side and experiential marketing, running all of the sampling, events, festivals, which was a dream job for someone in their mid-20s. And then when Pop Chips came to launch in the UK, so around the time that Vitamin Water sold to Coke, Pop Chips was coming up and they poached a lot of the original marketing people. So when they came here, they just said, find the person that did the Vitamin Water marketing, which happened to be me. So I had quite a fortuitous lucky break and then the right place, right time again.
What an amazing intro into FMCG marketing. Just go straight into Vitamin Water and doing the tour of music festivals.
Yeah, I was very popular for a time there with my friends.
Everyone was sleeping in your tent and having electrolytes pumped into their veins the following morning as well. That's so cool. Okay, great. And then you started at Pop Chips and you were there for 7 years, was it? As the second person in the Pop Chips business in the UK, what was, like, how did you guys get down to it? What was the first order of business and what were the sort of founding pillars of actually launching the brand in the UK?
It was super scrappy. We were in like a basement room in this office building in Shepherd's Bush that was just like cardboard boxes just piled high. So there were just four of us for, I think, 18 months. And it was just super scrappy. And having said that, at the same time, we went straight into Waitrose on day one of our launch. So it was this kind of weird combo where we were sat in a broom cupboard, but we went in day one into Waitrose main estate, and we did a big out-of-home campaign in London, and we wrapped a load of taxis, and we had this amazing launch campaign playbook from the US that we followed. The main thing I remember about it is just hitting the ground running and then running probably flat out for about 4 years, running back and forth from an access self-storage in Acton, handwriting notes that went out to influencers, managing agencies. It was just crazy from pre-day one. And I remember her first day, we all said that we need a bin, so we all traipsed off to the Shepherd's Bush shopping center to find some bins for the office. So that was actually the first
just the glamour of marketing, right?
Yeah. And then she was a bit like, what have I gotten myself into? I think we're all a bit like, what have we gotten ourselves into? I've just come from Coke basically and now I'm shopping for a bin. But anyway, yeah, like I say, we did a lot in a short amount of time, and that was from the very like nitty-gritty through to the bigger strategic stuff. But that is startup scale-up life.
That is, yeah. And it's quite cool as well, because like you said, you went into Waitrose from day one, which isn't typically a startup scale-up life. That is very much something that must have been unique to Pop Chips or other sort of US brands that are launching in the UK. So I guess what was similar in the UK versus the US? You said that you used the US playbook to launch in the UK. What did that look like and how did you guys tailor it for the UK market?
We didn't really tailor the marketing tactics. It was a good strategy and you still see it now. One snacker at a time, all about generating word of mouth, these like little details. We didn't change any of the fundamentals of that. I think how we had to change how the brand was communicated, but that was a slower process over time. I don't think it'd be a surprise to anyone to know that sense of humor changes between the UK and the US. So some of the copy we had to change, how we spoke about health, there were subtle differences, and that became more challenging a bit later when we started to get into what does the brand stand for, how do we need to communicate. When we first launched it, we did a sort of influencer campaign, but this was a time when there was no social, the only social media there was Facebook, and influencers as we think of them now didn't exist. It was real life influencers, which I think is great and more brands should do. We had these lists and lists of people who were friends of friends, people at the agency, investors, and they would get a box with a handwritten note, most of which I wrote initially. And then within that, they got to pop it forward to three people. And so you had this natural influence and network of people then sending it to people they knew. And that was how we built the brand. And that they were all brilliant ideas. So we didn't touch any of those. It was more the taglines, to be honest. And we didn't really realize that until we did some qual groups quite a lot later. And British people saying, I hate these. And that was a big challenge. But also it was a challenge because it's still a challenge now of that, how you like balance health and taste and how you communicate that. So yeah, it was more about how the brand sounded, but the personality of the brand and the kind of core central themes of it, plus the marketing strategy, we pretty much just replicated.
Yeah, so you kept the sort of ripple effect of marketing one consumer, one influencer at a time, spreading it through word of mouth, but the actual words coming out of the mouth were slightly different because you were catering to a much drier, more sarcastic market than the American market.
Yeah, I think that those sorts of things all happened over time. Initially, we just used what we had. It was then only, I think when you're launching and you're in that crazy, what gets you to a certain point isn't then what gets you to the next stage. So there was a point where we like took a step back and said, hang on, is this exactly right? And that was probably the when we were like, oh, no, it's not. That I think is quite common anyway. It's about landing with a big splash and then taking a bit of time to iterate, improve. But yeah, we definitely got things wrong along the way, that's for sure.
That's how you learn, right? Exactly. Through making mistakes. So I guess when you started off at Pop Chips, the FMCG better for you space, would you say it didn't really exist in the UK, or it was a very small market compared to where it is now?
Oh, it was completely different. So I think part of the reason Pop Chips was so successful, I guess the original founder story behind it was that Keith, the founder, who's amazing, so charismatic, said that he wanted to make healthier choices, but the only things that were available were these like diet products that he felt embarrassed to eat. So he tied them behind his sandwich as he was leaving the store. And that was where the idea for Pop Chips came from. So we didn't used to have calories on the front of the bag. They didn't look like a diet product, because at the time that's what Better For You was. And I guess in the UK it was like Special K who brought out some crisps about the same time, Snacker Jacks. Yeah, it didn't really exist. It was Slim Fast Weight Watchers. That was what Better For You was. It was just very diety, and it was all a bit sad and kind of about deprivation. And so Pop Chips were the first Better For You share bag, but also I think one of the first brands that helped make Better For You something a bit more positive. And now, obviously, it's like hugely aspirational, and there's where all the cool brands are. But there were no quote unquote cool brands in that category when we launched. And we weren't really trying to be cool, because I don't like that word when brands use it. I say that I think we were trying to be cool, and then Propercorn came out and just beat us to it all over the shop. But it was more about being something that you wouldn't feel embarrassed. It was about it being something that you'd feel happy eating, that you could take round to a friend's house and share them in a way that you wouldn't with a bag of Special K crisps or box. They were actually in a box when they launched.
Yeah, that's really funny. But I never heard that story about Keith being embarrassed to hide or like to eat diet food out in front of the public. So yeah, I guess that kind of makes sense, especially yeah, when you don't want the world to know that you're on a diet, but you also don't want to eat garbage either. It seems so obvious, but that's a really great origin story that I've never heard you tell.
we're so far away from that now, aren't we? It's gone like full pendulum the other way. And that was not, what, how long ago was that? 12 years ago? That wasn't that long ago, really, in the scheme of things. So amazing, actually, how things have moved on from then and how much more sort of positive healthy eating is seen, and the brands doing things in that space now, like you say, are the kind of most interesting, innovative brands generally. Yeah, huge change. And I think we were lucky. We were part of that, but also lucky with the timing, and that was the way the tide was turning as well. Can't take all the credit.
But I guess you guys were at the forefront of doing that at the time. It is actually so wild that was only 12 years ago, because it just feels like now you go to the grocery store and it's actually the complete opposite. Like, brands who are not better for you are calling out how they're better for you. So the tide really has turned in a big way. So I guess, would you say that like PopChip set that off, or do you just think that the movement was happening and you guys were really at the very beginning of that wave? I guess it was happening in the US.
It was happening in the US, as so many of these things start. I guess, you know, Vitamin Water being an early example of that, Coke bought it because it was the better for you play. Vita Coco, we had the same VC backing us. They were coming up at the same time as us, so they were really doing it in soft drinks. I'd say we were part of a cohort, probably one of the first to do it in snacking, but it was already happening in other categories. And just the demand for healthy eating. It's interesting because at the time we weren't paying a huge amount of attention to it. I remember when like Deliciously Ella and all the clean eating stuff came out, and I was a bit like, oh, is anyone ever going to eat crisps again? Are they all just going to be eating like dehydrated kale now? Are we going to be in loads of trouble here? And we quickly found like a middle ground, because they're not the healthiest thing you could eat. You could eat nuts would be better. Plenty of other things would be better, but it was that sort of middle ground where they were a bit better for you. And that was where we tried to occupy in the end. But it was tricky to talk about. We had a couple of good creative campaigns that I think started to get us closer to that. But yeah, we had one that was still like, be a bit good. And it was like, they're just a bit good.
That's good. And I guess the hint is in the name, right? It's better for you. It's not good for you. It is like better for you. But now that better for you, quote unquote, is so much more prevalent. We're just talking about better for you washing. What do you think brands can do to really set themselves apart from all the other better for you claims and USPs? What do you think it takes for a brand to stand out now that everyone's better for you?
I think the key thing, which has always been the case, and actually the main reason that PopChip did so, was it was a really great tasting product, and the category, cross category, but the whole better for you set has been damaged in the past, I think, by like bad innovation and bad tasting products, especially when brands then spend a lot of money trying to tell consumers they do taste good. And then it's just disappointing. And there's been a lot of that. I think it's a lot better now than it was, but there was definitely a point probably around when we were coming up with, there was just a lot of really like poor tasting stuff pretending to be tasty. So I think it all starts with taste, great, genuinely great taste. And I still think there are challenges. So when you come across a better for you product that genuinely tastes good, that is exciting. I think that kind of challenger brand aesthetic, we talked a little bit about it on a previous episode, that's not going to stand out anymore because that has become the kind of prevailing category aesthetic. If you look at the better for you category, I think that's challenger brand. Think about what you're challenging, who you're challenging, and then, you know, how you can differentiate rather than look at what all the other cool brands look like and also try and look like that. I think it's difficult because it has become so competitive and so cluttered. With Simply Roasted, we've had that challenge, and the packaging design that we came up with, which I still absolutely love, and it's one of my things that I'm happiest that I worked on, it was just super pared back, and really we just went for something that looked really premium and simple and like really rich colors, and it was trying to look more like a kettle chip or a Tyrrells versus trying to look like cool like proper corn. I think the key thing for me with better for you is that in order for it to work and actually do anything, you need to be winning consumers over from unhealthy products. You can't just win healthy consumers over from other better for you products. That's not changing behavior. I've always worked in better for you and like to pat myself on the back because it's encouraging people to eat better. But unless you're actually getting someone to trade out from something unhealthy, you're not really doing anything. So I think if you approach it from that perspective and you think, who are we trying to win share from? Is that actually doing anything, helping anybody make a better choice? And then if we do want that to happen, then, you know, what? How do we need to look? How do we need to sound? How can we differentiate?
Going back to your Pop Chips journey, 8 years in one job sounds unfathomable to me. And I'm sure many of the people who are listening, just because FMCG is so fast paced and people tend to hop around every 2 to 4 years, I would say. But how did the beginning differ from, say, 5 years in, 8 years in? So year one, it was you and a handful of people in a closet shopping for garbage cans. And what was like year 4 or 5 like versus that?
I think it didn't feel like the same job, which is probably why I stayed so long. And I did change roles within the business. But I think for me, I really grew with the business. I was pretty junior, and then I grew as the business grew. So it was never boring. I think that's how you end up staying somewhere as long as I did, because it was constantly changing. It was growing and I was growing and the team was growing. We grew year on year, every year. We went into new retailers, new channels. We got bigger budgets. So it changed, but the culture was so strong and so good there. That was consistent. And I've always loved being a part of things that are growing. I think there's a really specific energy around it. And when you're a marketeer, it's a much easier job to put fuel on a fire than it is to try and kindle a tiny little flame out of something that's damp.
Yeah. Okay. So your role changed within the business, but how, like, what was your starting role versus your ending role? And what did your responsibility change look like?
So I started as the field marketing manager, which was an American term, which is how you can tell that it was an American playbook we were following. And that, to be honest, that kind of meant doing a bit of everything, but it was very sampling focused. And then I just moved into a general marketing role. And then I did European marketing. So we were launching into Europe. So I worked on those launches, which was interesting experience. And then the last couple of years, I'd actually gone on maternity leave and come back and wanted a part-time role. And I was very lucky that the business created one for me, because honestly, that is what kind of made my career, enabled me to stay in a business that I loved and work around the commitments of a new family. So I'm forever grateful for that. So I moved into a head of innovation role, which they created for me, which meant I got to work on all the new shiny stuff that was coming up and find the category white space and come up with new concepts. And we had quite an interesting pipeline in the US. So like adapting things for here, selling it into retail, working cross-functionally, lots of Gantt charts, project plans. But yeah, I love that because it was getting to interpret the brand that I loved. And by that point, I think I was the brand. Like I was the unofficial. Any questions if something was on brand or not, I would just be like, yep, yeah, no, because I was the brand.
I love this interpretation that after 8 years of working day in and day out with Pop Chips, you became like Meta Pop Chips ex Ruth or something. And you just understood what was on brand, what was off brand. Like it wasn't even a question anymore. I just had to go to Ruth. She knew.
Yeah, it's like GPT.
I was just thinking that, like how your ChatGPT just knows you so well. It's Pop Chips. You are Pop Chips. You spit out Pop Chips when asked.
Yeah. It's like hard to imagine now because it feels so far away, but yeah, just right in the brand tone of voice so easily. You know, it wasn't me. I think that's the other key thing. It wasn't like, I wasn't ever the founder. It wasn't my voice. I just learned it.
Yeah.
And how to learn the language
inside out. Native tongue.
Yeah.
Amazing. Okay, so you became very close with the brand. You almost became one with the brand. And then KP Snacks bought the brand. What happened? How did you feel?
It was from the beginning, we were always building it to sell. We knew that. We all had share options. It was one of our brand values, which is my favorite one that I has always really resonated with me, and I've taken it into other businesses. And I guess now with Tomorrow Brands is we are all builders. Like, we knew we were building something, and every so often we'd be like, oh, do you think it's about to sell? I guess when it actually did, it was just slightly weird, because firstly, the UK business sold off separately. So that was slightly odd because it put us in a different position to our American team and our colleagues. And then there's a very long period where nothing really happens and you're all in this sort of like weird stasis between owners that we had to navigate. And for me, it was pretty good timing because firstly, I was pregnant with my second child, so I was going to go off anyway. But I would never have left that business probably. I was so happy there. Like I say, I was so comfortable. I just imagine myself in a rocking chair in the corner, just answering questions when I was 90 about what was on and off brand. And when you get that comfortable somewhere, it can get a little bit dangerous because you're not really growing anymore. So it was good in that it pushed me out. Had to start doing something else. But it was just, there wasn't a kind of big euphoric moment. People left at different times, so it was one department got wrapped up and everyone would transition over, and you'd say bye to 10 people and then it'd be a bit funny in the office. So I think those sorts of transitions are really hard, actually, especially for employees, because if you're the founder, there's probably different challenges and it feels different. But for employees, it's at the end of an era. We'd had such a good experience building it. And then, yeah, it was just done. The party's over.
Basically. The party's over. We've used that line before.
Yeah. But now when I see what KP have done with the brand and how truly mainstream it is, I'm really pleased by that. I think that's where all Better For You brands should be aspiring to be, total mainstream distribution. You know, that point again about helping people switch out, you can only do that when you're at a super accessible price point, which they are now. So I think it's been a really good journey. It was a good acquisition. And the brand's been managed well since. It's not that there weren't moments where you'd see and you'd be like, "That's no one asked me about that," because I would have said, "No, that is not on brand." But that has changed. But yeah, so it's sort of a bit of mixed emotions. I think pride in seeing it live on, and then also a little bit bittersweet as well.
Yeah, that's interesting that you guys had this almost the buyout in your KPIs throughout your time there as well. Obviously, you had the share options, etc. So it's like you knew what you were getting into, but then it's still difficult to see the business broken up into like different pieces, teams leaving at different times, and the brand taking on a new segment of its brand cycle.
We had a very good retention rate. So a lot of people would come and then stay. So it was, yeah, I wouldn't ever say, I hate that expression, it was like a family, because it absolutely wasn't. And I feel like you should run for the hills if the business describes and stuff like that. But we were a very good team.
Yeah. And do you think that contributed to the business's success? Because I know employee retention is really challenging for businesses, especially in such fast-moving businesses like FMCG startups. Do you think that was fundamental to the business's success?
I do. And I think that we were all treated really well as employees, and also that the atmosphere, it was busy and it was fast paced, but it was a very positive atmosphere. My boss would say, this is not, we're just selling crisps. Like, it's not doctors, not brain surgeons. It's not that bad. And when things went wrong, which of course they did, we all had a lot of autonomy, and it wasn't like we didn't take things seriously, but there wasn't a blame culture. We didn't dwell on things. It was a very positive environment, I think, which made then, it wasn't super stressful. I thought it was very well run. We were well managed. Those environments can be really chaotic. And maybe that is also what you get from it being like a startup, but also not, because it was a more established brand in the US, although it was still relatively new. But Will had come from Innocent and probably learned some things there around culture. So I think retention was part of it, but it was the reason people stayed that made it successful. We wanted to be people that people like doing business with, and that went through everything. So the way relationships we built with buyers, the way we worked with our retailers, like through to the way we managed agencies, the way we managed our teams. It was a kind of a, that this wasn't one of them, but it was a little bit of a work hard and be nice to people. That was the vibe. We knew that you get further by being someone that people want to work with. Rather, we were carrot, not stick mentality.
Work hard, be nice to people sounds like it should be everyone's fundamental way of working. It's nice that it ran through the business.
Yeah, it should be. It should be like that. I think you get a lot more out of it, but as we probably both know from experience, it's not.
I think it's hard once the pressure comes on to maintain that sort of sentiment, which seems so obvious when the pressure is not on, but when you've got investors chasing you and you've got deadlines to hit and targets that you're not hitting, then I think it's quite easy to let that sentiment, that sort of ambition for the business crumble, and it does become stressful. And so it's really cool that you guys managed to maintain that even though you were obviously high achieving. And I'm sure there must have been a few moments over the course of your 8 years where things didn't quite go according to plan.
I say it wasn't stressful. Now I'm thinking about it. I'm like, of course it was at times.
It's always tinted in the hindsight mirror.
Yeah. Do you know what though? What I think did make a difference and was my boss was a very calm, positive person. So actually, I can't remember a time where I saw him like get stressed or lose his temper. It's a bit like the analogy, if you're like an airplane and there's some turbulence and then the staff just look freaked out, like that's going to freak everybody out. And I've been in businesses like that. Whereas very calm, positive, steady hand. So yes, of course, there were things that went wrong and that were really stressful. I remember one of my biggest blunders was I remember accidentally putting a retailer logo on a print ad that went into the Metro, and we hadn't launched in that retailer yet. It was like the biggest coffee chain you can think of. And the listing was on a knife edge and it hadn't gone through yet. And we didn't know whether it was going to happen. So we'd done two versions of the creative, one with and one without. And I accidentally sent the wrong one to print. And then I was in a meeting with our PR agency and they said, oh, we saw your ad in the Metro. And I opened it and just almost had a heart attack. You know, when your like stomach just drops, and I was like, oh my God, that's the wrong ad. And yeah, the chain did not respond well to it. They made some threats. In the end, it was all fine. But I remember, and my boss said, just make sure it doesn't run tomorrow. Like, I've managed it. So I was on the phone to the Metro and nobody would tell me which one it was. And I ended up speaking to somebody and I could hear them printing in the background. There's just some poor guy on the like floor of being like, can you just check which one? And I could barely get out of bed the next morning. So I was like, I just cannot look if it's run again. And it hadn't. But I remember emailing the founder to say sorry, because it had gone all the way up because of the retailer was not happy. And he just wrote back and said, mistakes happen, just double check next time. And that was it. That was it.
Yeah.
It was like a line was drawn under it. And I think that was what I mean about the lack of blame culture. It was like things, if you're moving at pace, things are going to go wrong. And you can't afford to be micromanaging everybody in every situation. So you have to accept that sometimes things are going to go wrong. But if you also create an environment where people can fail, and then you take responsibility. If something went wrong, you own up to it, you say sorry. And then it's like, okay, that's that then. And then you never made that mistake twice.
That's a one-off misprint. That's not so bad if that was your biggest blunder in 8 years. Oh, I feel like I did 8 years of business.
Yeah, there's probably lots of little subtle ones that did more damage. They're just not as good a story. We saw I was going through some brand decks recently and I found some really bad taglines that I put out. I think there was one point we didn't really have a creative agency and we were just coming up with stuff in the office, and I sent them to Jess, who became our like marketing manager and stayed all the way through to acquisition as well, and was like, oh my God, have you seen these? They make like no sense. I was like, this is what you get when you let a 29-year-old with no experience sign off creative.
I write it and I sign it off.
I am the brand. I cannot be wrong.
Oh, that's okay. I still don't think any of that sounds too bad. Having listened to several of your podcasts, or all of your podcasts, actually, I frequently hear you talk about how sales and marketing often come to your heads, but you always say that you've always had a great experience working with your salesperson counterparts, sales director, heads of sales. How do you think sales and marketing departments can work harmoniously?
I think it's just being really aware of what each other do and having a respect for that, and knowing that marketing's job is to drive sales. It should be a support for the sales team. So to take the time to have regular, really regular, both of the last businesses I was in, the last one, the sales director and I would talk multiple times a week about what we were doing, what was coming up. Some of the time it's just that explaining what you're doing and why and how it's going to help them. Them talking about the challenges they've got. It's not as simple as you can't like turn a tap on and suddenly bump rate of sale. There are a few hacky things that you can do. Yeah. If you know that being as joined up as you can be, even if it's being aware of brand performance over the course of the year, which are the key moments, like obviously you need to know when the promotional, what promotional plan is. You should be working together on that. It just is a, and I think when you're in a small business, so Pop Chips, we'd have quarterly meetings, we'd have Monday morning meetings where you'd all go around and just share that. So we were always very plugged into everything that was going on in the business. Everybody was. And I really took that for granted. That was just how things were. And I think it's made me a lot better at my job, because even though I don't profess to be an expert in any other area, I know enough about them to know how my job interacts with that and what I can do to support that and how important it all is, and also to have a lot of respect for those other departments. And I do think that can be lacking. Marketing should be commercial. It should be linked to commercial. You need to understand the impact of what you're doing. You need to be able to communicate what you're doing and why. I think as you get more senior, that becomes more and more important. You're in a lot of ways moving information around and making sure that you're bringing people on the journey with you. It doesn't mean you need everybody's opinion on everything or everyone's sign off on everything, but it's that communication should be completely open both ways, and just having a really strong relationship with your counterpart in sales, no matter what level of marketing you're at, I think is a really good, really positive thing.
Yeah, that's nice. And what is one lesson that you learned at Pop Chips that you've taken with you throughout the rest of your career?
So many. Work hard and be nice to people, probably being one of them, that you can build a really successful business and not lose your mind and treat people well along the way. And I think that's really stayed with me, how important a good culture is to everything. I think it does make such a difference, because any of these businesses are all just some of the parts of the people that are working there. And if everybody's miserable and stressed and feels like they have no autonomy and they can't make decisions, or it's dysfunctional because the processes are all over the place, of course that has an impact on performance. And to your point, even if it's just that everybody leaves and then you've then got this big gap. So I think the strength of a good culture, that, like we say, I guess our other brand values were we are all in marketing. So that kind of brand, I love working on in brands as a like brand first and really have a respect for brand. And that was always inherent in Pop Chips. It was the brand was at the center of everything. Everybody got it. It wasn't like there were jokes made at the expense of the marketing department, as the coloring in department. But actually, at the core of everything, there was a real appreciation of brand. It probably taught me most of what I know, really, in some way or another. And it's interesting because you don't realize until later. There are some things that aren't directly obvious. I really love now, like brand strategy, even though that wasn't really part of my role. It was a bit at the end with the innovation. But I think that comes from seeing the power of a really strong brand.
And last but not least, I don't know if you know this, but anyone who comes on the Tomorrow Brand podcast gets asked the same question right at the end. What makes a brand of tomorrow?
I've thought a bit about this, obviously, because I've heard a lot of answers. Mine's quite boring, but I think it's resilience. I think sometimes it's just surviving. Like you, some of the brands that you see that have been going for years, the legacy brands, the really iconic ones, they've just hung on. And I do think that there's a lot in that. That Popchits, we were really lucky. We had all this year-on-year growth that made a lot of things easier. It's not always like that. It's rarely like that. So having resilience, the ability to survive, whether that's a good runway, whether that's agility, knowing the difference of when to pivot and when to stick. But yeah, I do think that the brands we'll still see in 20, 50 years time will be the ones that's hung on, sometimes even by a fingernail, to the edge and just hung on.
That's not a boring response at all. I've listened to all the podcasts and heard all the responses, and that's really interesting because I never actually think, I feel like we're in this total cluster of better for you and modern brands, and it's just going so much further in that direction that actually, you're right, I don't really think about which brands are going to be here in 20, 30, 50, 100 years time, like which ones, but hanging on for dear life, even through the rough times, is what makes the brand of tomorrow. It's going to be those guys who are hanging on in 100 years time.
I think what I've learned from working with a few more sort of legacy heritage brands recently is that like patience of sometimes just being able to wait something out. And at the moment, the last few years have been incredibly like tumultuous, and it's meant the demise of quite a few businesses, sadly, which is also understandable. So the ability to wait it out should not be underrated.
Riding out the storm.
Thanks, Ruth.
Thanks for letting me interview you and tell the story of your time at Popchits. Super interesting.
Thank you, Sophia.